Chapter 12. Three Steps to the Modern. 1. The tide had crawled up unperceived. By 1850, the earlier world of this bay had been erased. Over three or four centuries, the tide of modernity had eaten away at its foundations. Politics and trade came to matter more than climate or soils. Local adaptations and institutions were overwhelmed. The culture that had developed here was slowly replaced by the demands of a distant market and the growing technological, military and institutional power of the state. The life of most people in Morven came to seem like an excrescence, and often with carelessness, brutality and humiliation, they were removed. It was a tragic clash, a modernizing, globalizing and eventually industrializing world, at its most expansive, met an essentially pre-modern society whose ways of being and thinking, its duches, were subtle, evolved, rich and sustaining, but fragile in front of these demands. In 1843, 500 radical ministers in the Church of Scotland, responsive to this sense of destruction, had left the church in protest against the Patronage Act, by which landowners were able to choose their local minister, a choice in which the people had no say. The protesters set up what they called the Church of Scotland Free, the Free Kirk, and were forced to leave behind any land-based buildings in which to preach. All over the country they met in the open air. Mr. MacLean of Tobermory held services on the hillside, often in severe weather. Some conducted the whole service under heavy rain, others in snow, the fall being so heavy that at the close, one minister said, I could hardly distinguish the congregation from the ground on which they sat, except by their faces. One church was built inside a distillery. Many services were held on the verges of the public roads. People walked 15 miles across the hills to hear these sermons. These were moments of the deepest emotion. Enormous congregations of 2,000 or more would be hanging on the lips of the speakers, often dissolving in tears at the redemption that was offered, and with deep sobs heard throughout. In many places, worshippers gathered on the shore, and the minister spoke from the bow of a moored boat. The shore, because it did not belong to the landowners, was a place in between, the realm of exclusion, but also of liberty. At Strontian on Loch Sunart, the people had built by their own subscription a floating iron church, 80 feet long, in which, anchored to the loch bed, 750 hearers could fit on the benches. The popularity of the preachers could be judged by the depth to which the hull sank in the water, an inch for every 100 extra of the faithful. At Loch Dunhead in Mull, just across the sound from the bay beyond Duett, the people were forced to meet in a canvas tent they had put up on the floor of a gravel pit that was on the edge of the sea loch. During one service, the attention of a visiting minister from the lowlands was diverted by an unaccountable commotion among those who were seated within the tent. He could not understand what the trouble was. He knew this to be the most attendant of congregations. Then he saw that the minister himself was looking towards the ground in an uneasy manner. The visitor then looked beneath his own chair. The tide had crawled up unperceived, and there sat the congregation, not one left his seat, and there stood the preacher, all ankle-deep in the tide, which had thus stealthily crept up to them while they were solemnly engaged in the most sacred rite of the church. The preacher drew his address to a close. A short parting psalm was sung, for the spot was on the margin of a shallow, landlocked bay, in which the tide rose slowly. The benediction was pronounced, and the congregation, many of them moved to tears, quietly dispersed to their homes. Lament, at its most extreme, will always have to encounter water, Alice Oswald has said recently, and these desperate and touching stories mark the moment when the people of this place were driven into the sea. 2. Survival of the fittest. At the same instant, the love affair between educated Victorian Britain and the edges of the sea was entering its most intense phase. High on the ridge to the west of the bay, a large and beautiful house had been built in the middle of the 18th century by a gentleman from Appin, its porch covered in honeysuckle and jasmine, its square and sunny upstairs drawing room looking out over the bay and the sound towards the Mull Hills. Here, as Philip Gaskell, the landlordist historian of Morven, has described, rich, cultured foreigners, who had no professional interest in the land, migrated to the West Highlands for lengthy holidays to walk and shoot and fish and relax in a country of insidious beauty. I only realised, long after I began to look into the story of this place, that the most famous phrase ever used to describe life on Earth was written in that house in the late summer of 1864 by a man of enormous fame at the time who is scarcely remembered now, a bachelor intellectual in Argyll on holiday, who had been entertaining the other guests and the children of the house with the three aquariums he had set up, and for which he had gathered plants and animals from these shores and waters. That summer he was revising the latest instalment of his giant, all-comprehending study of man, nature, and the world. In 1860, the bay and its surrounding lands had been bought by Octavius Smith, a vastly successful London distiller who was also part of a self-consciously free-thinking, free-market, anti-establishment milieu intent on changing the conservative habits of mid-Victorian Britain. Energetic, resourceful, full of enterprise and set against any government interference in the pursuit of his business, Smith was the purest version of a Victorian meritocrat. He had been introduced to Herbert Spencer, the libertarian and impoverished philosopher, whose articles in the Westminster Review and elsewhere had promulgated opposition to what he repeatedly called government meddling. The two became the best of friends, and when Smith bought his Highland estate here, Spencer was usually among the guests for the summer holidays, varying in duration as they did from a month to 6 weeks and even 2 months. Spencer had been born into a highly religious, nonconformist background, from which he had inherited an innate opposition to authority. In time, he lost his faith in God or any form of creator, and became part of that modern philosophical movement which was set on questioning all received ideas. He was no scientist himself, and was thought faintly ridiculous by those who were, but a theoretician of natural law for whom the principle of evolution became the fundamental fact of existence. Spencer saw a world animated by a steady progress towards an ever more individuated and developed ideal. In nature, in human psychology, in human cultures and societies, there was an imperturbable drive towards that ever finer condition. In 1858, he drew up his Outline of a System of Synthetic Philosophy, in which biology, psychology, sociology, and ethics were all to be brought together under this single vision of evolution towards excellence. The London distiller felt confirmed by him. The ultimate result of shielding men from the effects of folly, Spencer liked to say, is to fill the world with fools. The great principle was the progressive adaptation of constitution to conditions. The French evolutionist Jean-Baptiste Lamarck had envisaged the necessary mechanism. In any body, any mind, or any society, the increase or decrease of structure was consequent on increase or decrease of function. If a giraffe stretched for the highest leaves on a tree, its progeny would be born with longer necks. Northerners who moved to sunny countries would have dark-skinned children. Puppies born to hounds already knew what had been taught to their parents. How this actually happened, Spencer could not say, but the assumption was that any transformation of a body, a mind, or a social organism would be transmitted to its successors and descendants. The giant System of Synthetic Philosophy would demonstrate the coherence of this idea in all conceivable dimensions. It was, in a sense, a form of self-justification. Spencer and his friends had emerged from non-establishment, relatively humble backgrounds to dominate their world. He had become better than those he saw around him, and what he was, his descendants would surely also be. An unaddressed hole lurked in the centre of the proposed world system. There was no identified means by which this idea of evolution operated. Then, in July 1858, a composite paper by Charles Darwin and Alfred Wallace was read at the Linnaean Society in London, and the idea of natural selection as the origin of species burst on the world. The presence of death was revealed as the shaper of life. Just as a breeder of hens or hounds would choose the best for their purposes, death in nature would select the survivors. Environment, predation, and competition made the selection, preserving, as Darwin said, only the favoured races in the struggle for life. A new candidate had surfaced for the greatest idea in Victorian England. Spencer, in his mid-40s and now a desperate hypochondriac, was on holiday here when the paper was read. I have but a vague impression of the way in which this event became known to me, but my belief is that I remained in ignorance of it until my return to town in October. It was a devastating moment. Someone else had understood the mechanism by which evolution happened. Spencer held that the sole cause of organic evolution is the inheritance of functionally produced modifications. But he was wrong. There was no grand spirit of progress pushing creation towards ever more evolved forms. Change did not come about by inheritance from antecedents. Chance mutation, acted on and selected by the demands of the environment, was the way that life diversified. Then Spencer remembered something. This idea had already occurred to me in the course of a country ramble with Mr. G. H. Lewis in the autumn of 1851. The thesis was that organic forms in general, vegetal and animal, are determined by the relations of the parts to incident forces. He kicked himself that he had not developed the idea more fully at the time, and now Darwin had scooped the prize. Money worries, the fight against the church establishment, the struggle to establish a coherent vision of existence, the pervasiveness of change. From all of this, Spencer was suffering. I was able to work, at the best, only 3 hours a day, and often not that. And there occasionally came relapses which forced me to leave off for a time entirely. He was wrapped in his own solitary struggle. I once discovered, to my dismay, that I sometimes passed those living in the same house with me, and though I looked them in the face, remained unconscious that I had seen them. He often could not sleep, and had regular recourse to one or other preparation of opium. The strain of writing overtaxed him, and his habit now was to dictate his prose. En route to the bay in Oban, he had found a youth of some 18 or so, sufficiently educated to serve as amanuensis, and when on holiday here, liked to spend his afternoons paddling about in Ard Tornish Bay and dictating while I rowed. His working papers do not survive, but it is not inconceivable that the most famous phrase in biological thought was coined when out on the water of the bay itself. The coast is very rich, and I expect to get many novelties, he wrote to his mother, and years later in his autobiography described his happiness here, setting up the aquariums, showing the other guests how to use a microscope, fishing in the rivers and walking on the cliffs, loving the gorgeous colours of clouds and sky, while listening to Beethoven sonatas played by the girls on the house piano. In the late summer of 1864, he was revising that part of his Principles of Biology that was to be published the following October. He had come to the point where he had to admit Darwin's discovery. Perhaps, much as a starfish absorbs the meat of a mussel, Spencer could absorb natural selection into his own system. A man writing by dictation tends to long-windedness, and so you must imagine him out in the bay as he pulls gently on the oars, the young boy sitting in the stern sheets, taking down the precious words. Doubtless many who have looked at nature with philosophic eyes have observed that death of the worst and multiplication of the best must result in the maintenance of a constitution in harmony with surrounding circumstances. The destruction of the weak will always demonstrate that organisms which live thereby prove themselves free to live, insofar as they have been tried, while organisms which die thereby prove themselves in some respects unfitted for living. This self-acting purification of a species must tend ever to ensure adaptation between it and its environment. He has by now rowed across the bay to Rua und Tassenach, has turned the boat, and is slowly making his way back towards the house, tea, Beethoven and companionship. Applying alike to the lowest and the highest forms of organisation, there is in all cases a progressive adaptation and a survival of the most adapted. That was the first run at it, but he then came to the final wording. This survival of the fittest, which I have here sought to express in mechanical terms, is that which Mr. Darwin has called natural selection, or the preservation of favoured races in the struggle for life. Darwin had not used survival of the fittest as a phrase. Many of his followers disliked the term natural selection, as it implied an agency doing the selecting, and preferred Spencer's term as it encapsulated the blindness of the process. In time, and in later editions of On the Origin of Species, Darwin, who considered Spencer full of dreadful hypothetical rubbish, would nevertheless adopt survival of the fittest as the truth at the heart of the evolution of life. For all the precision of his words, Spencer could not accept that natural selection was the only mechanism by which life evolved. Doggedly, he held on to the idea of the inheritance of acquired characteristics. Perhaps he had to. Darwin's idea represented a peculiarly modern anarchy, while Spencer's cherished idea of evolution towards excellence was deeply connected to his mid-19th century view of the reality of progress. Gradually, in the second half of his life, that view came to seem not only biologically wrong, but naively optimistic. The need of a lonely, sickening man to systematize the whole of experience, to give it the comfort blanket of a single, enveloping principle by which the better and the best, like Spencer and Octavius Smith and all the brilliant Smith children, would always emerge on top. But life was not a relentless drive towards the perfect. The general crisis of the early 20th century and the devastations of the Great War finally revealed the comfort and self-assurance of this Spencerian vision to have been hopelessly wrong. Evolution towards excellence was not the ultimate truth, but the delusion of successful Victorians who imagined they were the natural outcome of laws that governed the universe. 3. Being with. I also rowed out in the bay, looked at creatures in my aquarium, and peered down into the pools to find there the subtle structures of animal and vegetable life. I felt a million miles from Spencer's expectation of evolution towards perfection, but what to replace it with? Floating out on the bay, I instead read a short and brilliant book by George Steiner about a very different figure from a very different time. A small boat on a calm autumn sea is a beautiful and easy place to read and gently absorb Steiner's unfolding of the difficult and opaque ideas of the great early 20th century German philosopher Martin Heidegger. My expectations were not high, because Heidegger comes with the darkest of clouds hanging over him. He was a Nazi, promoted by the Nazis, promulgating the virtues of Nazism to his students, and after the hellish revelations of Belsen and Auschwitz, never once explaining or apologising for his involvement with the Nazi cause. The beauty and marvel of Steiner's book is its ability to find in Heidegger, alongside the active partisan in barbarism, a man he could also call a philosopher of towering stature. Slowly, page by page, I followed Steiner, searching for wisdom and understanding in the works of a man he confronts as a lifelong anti-Semite, who in the 1930s had been caught up in the electric trance of Nazism, and who after the war lurked in a long, dark and ugly silence. For Steiner, born in 1929 in Paris to Viennese Jewish parents, to have written this book seemed increasingly to me an act of courage and grace, not of forgiveness, as there can be no forgiveness for the crimes of a Nazi vision that in many ways acted out the most wicked assumptions of a Spencerian imposition of excellence, but of generosity and civilization. By sheer chance, I had met Steiner a year or two before he wrote this book. I was 18, and he came to speak to some of us at school. I was asked to look after him, and I remember now his sheer brightness, as small-boned as a bird, looking up at us and asking about our lives and ideas. As I took him back to the headmaster's house, he turned and said, "Never forget the beauty of what you now are." Words that seemed more than strange at the time, but wonderful in retrospect, a measure of the generosity and scale of spirit that animated him. And so Steiner, as much as Heidegger, was out with me in the bay, and on the Ruhr und Tassenach, all three of us there in our ragged waterproofs and tattered waders. During the terrible troubles in Germany after the end of the Great War, years filled with poverty, violence and despair, Heidegger's ambition was to reshape the whole of Europe's intellectual heritage. He saw it, in a way, quite simply. Two streams had descended to us from ancient Greece, from Plato, who wanted to find ultimate reality and value beyond this world, in a realm of ideal forms of which mundane existence was only a weak and shadowed projection, and from Aristotle, who wanted to find meaning in the actuality and mechanics of the physical world as it was. From Plato came the long and grand tradition of metaphysics, of considering this life less than another to which we have no real access. From Aristotle came the world of science, which excludes the questions of ultimate meaning and attends only to the facts as they are. For centuries, Europe had been enthralled to the first, the centuries of religion. The modern industrialized world of technology and the exploitation of nature is enthralled to the second. Both visions for Heidegger are inadequate, either condemning life on Earth to an empty shadow play or turning us into predatory users of our world. Both are empty and eviscerated, both are unhappy. Both are diminishing and destructive. Heidegger's word for this is privative. These traditional understandings of life take away the heart of existence. By emphasizing either the otherworldly or the exclusively material, they induce in us a forgetting of being. Heidegger thought that since ancient Greece, we had forgotten how to be in the world. One of those phrases that produced in me the strange and enlarging experience of learning something new that nevertheless seemed to articulate what I'd always half thought, even if in an inchoate and unexpressed way, but which now appeared fully illuminated. That was the recognition of what I had always known, given me by Heidegger Steiner on the rocks. I have always thought that neither science nor religion is good enough. But what to put in their place? The Heideggerian answer is something Steiner translates as total there-ness, a life which is soul and spirit deep in that which is. Phrases circling that idea come rolling around again and again, the luminous there-ness of what is, the highest densities of meaning lying in the immediate. Being is not a chance or a choice, because being in the world is as it is. To be at all is to be worldly. The radiant autonomy of organic and inorganic objects. The revelatory nature of real concreteness. These glowing realities add up to what Heidegger calls the house of being. But what, really, is that underlying being, the there-ness to which we must commit our lives? Neither Heidegger nor Steiner can finally say. But Steiner finds a beautiful analogy. We know what this reality of being is, the being beyond the surface manifestations of being, when listening to music. Music, Steiner says, enters the body and mind at manifold and simultaneous levels. But how or why it does that eludes us. Wherever possible, we consign the question either to technicality or the limbo of the obvious. Yet we know what music is. We know it in the mind's echoing maze and in the marrow of our bones. We assign to it an immensity of meaning. What does it mean? When Schumann was asked what one of his compositions meant, his answer was to play it again. In music, being and means of being are inextricable. This is not metaphysical, not about any other world than this. Heidegger Steiner's description is of this world, the world as it is, full as it is of contradictory simultaneities and repeated chances of ecstatic encounter. Neither Plato, thinking reality is elsewhere, nor Aristotle, attached to the atomized physical, could know about it. Nor is it any form of balm, relieving one of the anxiety and difficulty of being, as the Platonic dream or the Aristotelian forgetting of wider significance might have done. Heidegger's world recognizes the reality of anxiety, and above all the reality of death, our own finitude, as the condition of life. We can live only in the uncertainty of our reality. We must be patient, because to know how to wait is to know how to question being. Steiner paraphrases the Heideggerian tangle. Thought must descend humbly to the poverty of its tentative condition. Here now, beside the pools, Heidegger Steiner approached the core of the idea. The way to be in the world is being with. To understand the presentness of all others is to exist. Being with others makes us who we are, and the acceptance of others enlarges us. The co-presence of others, both given and received, becomes the frame in which knowledge is possible. Concern for them is the central connective tissue, and only the recognition of the reality of individual death, the limited nature of individual life, can lead to an engagement with what is here now. Only a life that recognizes the actual and the daily can hope to be true. And so Heidegger arrives at a vast and humane vision, in a thought that encapsulates what Steiner called his vehement humanity. I care, therefore I am. This central concern is for more than humanity. It is care for all that is, and as such is the opposite of Descartes' idea that he is because he thinks. The world exists beyond any knowing you might have of it. Knowing is not a process of returning with one's booty to the cabinet of consciousness. It is, on the contrary, a form of being with, a concern, a lingering alongside. That, for Heidegger, is the paradoxical condition of true liberty. Knowing your life is limited, with a bracing awareness of one's finitude, you will care for all others, coming alongside them and being with the world in a freedom which is both certain of itself and anxious. It is one of the great statements of the marvellous. Death is not an event, but an aspect of being, and its principal effect is not, eventually, to kill you, but to generate a life lived in the awareness and recognition of all others. Care, Heidegger says, in summation, is the primordial condition. Care and true being are indivisible. These great and revolutionary thoughts are almost a century old. They seem scarcely to have been absorbed by the culture, but they came to shape my time at the rock pools. The coexistence with the things of the pool, the being with them, a total co-presence with them, came to seem like a way of establishing my own being in the world. To be with is the only way to be. Not being with, to be in real isolation, and allowing no penetration of the you into the I, can only be a form of non-being, a gravityless floating in an atomized and disconnected universe which has lost all significance beyond the service it is said to provide for an eye-fixated humanity. Service? You have to ask what service the prawn had in mind when it was selected for the sandwich, or the crab for its mayonnaise. No creature, no set of creatures, and no networked relationship of creatures provides any service to us. We prey on them. The ego is essentially predatory. We take and use the world, carelessly destroy the conditions for which its inhabitants have evolved, and casually engineer another world-destroying crisis, equivalent to the disaster that made the lifeless rocks on Ruhr und Tasnach some 200 million years ago. An understanding of Heidegger's care, Heidegger's being with, and Heidegger's diminution of the thinking self is the only way we can change the way we think of our own being. Confronted with the grand crisis of nature, Heidegger provides the most powerful set of ideas, an all-pervading consciousness of the autonomy of other life, a recognition, at this most enveloping of philosophical levels, that we cannot exist unless embedded in it, the need to remain anxious at its unsettlingness, not as a failure to resolve problems, but as a recognition of their reality, and our own finitude beside it. The pointlessness of making the pools, so many people asked, but what are they for, was their value. They were for nothing. Making the pools was not the point. Being there while making them, what Heidegger calls lingering with being, was what was valuable, an inadvertent and marginal benefit that strikingly bears the same relationship to making something useful as the shore does to the sea itself. A revelatory edge that, by definition, is no good for shipping. There is much to be said about the state of the world's seas, the levels of destruction, the hypocrisies of policy makers, the empty designations of sea areas that are meant to be protected, but which are unpoliced and effectively unprotected, our inability to confront our own rapaciousness. But behind those destructive behaviours is a deeper and more fundamental question about our sense of who we are, what it is to be, and what it is to understand. The things of the world exist, whether we are with them or not, and our presence with them is made significant only by their being with us. Nature is more than a quarry to be eaten away at by our own ego-fixated technologies. "I do not want to be reflective any more," Louis MacNeice wrote a few years after Heidegger was thinking about these things. "The tide comes in and goes out again. I do not want to be always stressing either its flux or its permanence. I do not want to be a tragic or philosophic chorus, but to keep my eye only on the nearer future, and after that let the sea flow over us. Come then, all of you, come closer, form a circle, join hands and make believe that joined hands will keep away the wolves of water who howl along our coast, and be it assumed that no one hears them among the talk and laughter. Be with the shore, be with its others, be with everyone there, listen to the wolves, consider the nearer future, and fill it with talk and laughter." Conclusion. The Last Pool. As winter came on, I built a third pool further down the tide, in the richer and fiercer environment of the lower shore. It was to be different from the others, not dug in with a pickaxe, nor made by damming a hollow, but by forming a MacNeicean circle next to a rock buttress down in amongst the weed. When I first saw a place that might work, at the far eastern end of Ruhr und Tasnach, a storm was blowing and the winter sea was surging to and fro across it, the fronds of the weed whiplashed in the waves, the wolves of water howling on the shore. As soon as it calmed, I got the foundations in. No measurements, scraping at the limestone to get a good bedding for the wall, but leaving the seaweeds around it, so that the pool would start not as a raw and empty rock dish, but an enclosed part of the seabed, a park more than a garden. I would make the boundaries, and the sea and its life could wander in. I saw it now as a frame for being with. Every day, squeezing the work into the hour or two it was open on either side of a low tide, I added concrete to the wall. Within a week it was done, and I knew then I had to be patient. I left it to rest, so that it would have time to become itself, thinking I would return in the spring. Then life disrupted all plans. The pandemic of 2020 struck, and the shore was out of bounds for months. It was high summer before Sarah and I came back. We were too impatient to wait for low tide, and as soon as we could we took the boat across to the headland. It was the most perfect of days, the tide slipping easily out across the weeds of the upper shore. The sea had yet to drop. Water flowed seamlessly between the inside and outside of the pool, blurring the concrete, and the pool looked exactly as I had imagined it all winter and spring, half visible, buried in the sea, sunk like a memory. As the tide fell, the wall and pool emerged, a cupping of the sea, a stilling. Already unvisited, multiple life forms had taken up residence in it, and over the weeks of the summer, I made a map of what was there. It varied all the time, the weeds, the sponges, the limpets, and tiny newly seeded barnacles were all fixed and remained constant, but other animal life came in on one tide and left on the next. Sometimes the pool was nearly bereft of creatures. At others, it met me with spectacular surprises. I felt like a child when I arrived one day to find a starfish sprawled in the 1 foot depths of the central channel, its arms looking as sugar crusty as an Eccles cake, covered in the tiny self-cleaning organs, the pedicellariae with which it picks away any weed or creature that tries to colonize its surface. Only because of the pedicellariae is the starfish so bright. Its wavering tube feet reach out to the stones around it like the fingers of a man looking to know where he is in the dark. Then, on one unforgettable day, the common sea star spread its 12 pink and white tuft-encrusted limbs across the sunlit edges of the shallows, as brilliant as if it were newly made, just as assiduous as its cousin in cleaning its own body, so that it looked more like a dish of strawberries and cream that had arrived from Mars than a thing of the Scottish seas or a coral reef steadily on the move, as huge and deliberate as the giant tracked vehicles that transport rockets to the launch pad at Cape Canaveral. A bicolour garden, the prettiest of dresses, a toothbrush from paradise, a radiant morning gleaming from the shallows. It was there for one tide only, and never returned. I picked the near-perfect Venetian spiral of a painted topshell out of the bottom of the deeps. I watched the barnacles filtering life from water, and the carnivorous little dog whelks looking for their own meaty rewards. Sometimes I found their empty victims, the shells of other creatures neatly bored with a single hole drilled through them for the whelk to get its meat. It was a time of absorption, the shore animals putting on their cavalcade at every turn. This wasn't fixity, but something happening, oscillating not only with the tide, but from one day to the next, each manifestation of the pool a different patch of life over time. An urchin was there one day, perhaps washed in from lower down the tide, a pink pom-pom, but clearly the cousin of a starfish, its five arms still marked on the globe of its body, but as surface gestures, memories of the limbs its ancestor had once possessed. Like the starfish, the urchin was moving through its world with its hundreds of tube feet, beautiful dancer arms emerging from between its spines, extending their fingers into the surrounding weed and sea, and equipped, like the starfish, with the pedicellariae that keep it bright. I had read something by Graham Harman, who teaches philosophy at SIARC in Los Angeles. He had written about Kant's distinction between phenomena, everything that humans are able to encounter, perceive, use, or think about, and noumena, which, by contrast, are things in themselves that we never experience directly, since we remain trapped in the conditions of human experience. All we can know are phenomena, what we know or think we know of other beings. Those beings themselves are unknowable. The underlying nature of reality is beyond our grasp. It remains inevitably and permanently enclosed in its noumenal distance, and so we do not have access to creatures in themselves. We can encounter the phenomenal sight, the brightness, the smoothness, the wrinkliness, the brilliance, but we have no access to what they are beyond these surface qualities. The mystery of things is not metaphysical, but implicit in the existence of everything that is. I would never know the animals nor the rocks on which they lived. All I could know is what my senses and the sciences told me of these strangers' qualities. Harman talked later about what he called the object-qualities rift. The sensed object is not a bundle of qualities. The thing simply is. What the object is more than its qualities, and this is a universal condition. We share this unknowing with all existence, but there is no hierarchy here. If we share ignorance, we also share a kind of undeniable being. All is equally and gleamingly present. An ice boulder, the rigidified basalt, the flooding sea, the gulls standing looking bereft in the sunshine, the slow-feeling tube arms, hydraulically driven, of the starfish, the urchin and the sea star. We are all equally marvellously here, even as the tide laps up around our knees. The pool was that cup of wonder for me, as I made the daily trip across the bay to find it again, anchoring the boat to the rock and letting the breeze drift it out to the length of its rope into the sea, and then looking again into the shallow depths. Shallow depths! That was everything this year had been about, the fractal way in which unknowability can be found in the shallows of a pool, where layers of complexity constitute the lovely puzzles Stephen Jay Gould had described. Plato said that wonder is the feeling of a philosopher, and philosophy begins in wonder. But the sense of the word in Greek is not awe or amazement, the inadvertent wow when meeting the beautiful, but the sense of puzzlement, the perplexity of realizing you do not know at some level what is true. The tens of thousands of scientific papers devoted to this life can only concentrate on how it is, the workings of life. But that presence of the puzzling wonderful is surely the engine behind it all. They were magical weeks. Categories seemed to fuse. Perhaps it was the circumstances, the distant human world held in the grip of its own viral infection. Me, here now, away from that trouble, embedded in the subtle and expressive life of the pools. I felt such gratitude. The existence of things seemed to be continuous with the ways that existence made itself apparent. The phenomenal surface seemed for a moment like a route to the noumenal, to the undeniable reality of things as they are. I explored the low shore around the pool and came to see that I had merely built another patch in it, in an environment that was already patchy. Every different turn and wrinkle of the rock created a different place, different in its exposure to storm waves, different in depths, and so in length of submersion, different in the ability of plants and animals to live there. Patchiness was the essential quality of this world. Would it be possible to detect the tensions at work within it? At first it does not look tensed at all. This pool is on the lip of the very lowest spring tides. From here I can look back up at a well-ordered shore, a plain staircase of seaweeds, the same as on any northern rocky coast, stepping down towards me from dry land. At the very top, next to the grass, and in a place where fresh water runs off the land, is some bright green gutweed, fresh, transient and fragile. Below that is the channeled wrack, or channel wrack, so called because each sprig of each frond encloses a shallow channel, just narrow enough for the seawater to be held in there by its own surface tension when the tide drops away, so that these channels make miniature rock pools for the weed, ensuring that it stays damp on a hot afternoon. Just below it is the spiral wrack, slightly darker, in whose twisting and turning lobes the water will also remain between the tides. Both spiral and channel rack are able to rehydrate more quickly and more thoroughly, and after a deeper desiccation than all the other weeds. They are made to thrive on the upper shore. Below them comes bladder rack, living for far longer below the tide, supplied with air bladders that lift it towards the light when submerged. Its larger cousin, grape or knotted rack, comes next, right down to the pool itself, mixed in there with the serrated rack, its leaves more robust, thicker, and more difficult to tear than the others, with its margins cut away, perhaps so that it can better survive the thrashing given it by storm waves out here on these exposed rocks. A red parasitic weed called rack siphon weed attaches itself to the hanks of grape rack. Below those racks and just below the pool I had made come the kelps, exposed to the air only at exceptionally low tides. Giant-bladed brown weeds, some as single longer fronds, others further out and more exposed, wrinkled or divided into many fingers, also as a protection against storm waves, whose energy is broken by the multiple surfaces of the wrinkled kelp and the many fingers of its digitated cousin. At the very lowest of the tide, when you wade around within the serrated rack and the kelps, pulling aside the dark of their shade, you find the dulse, growing on the rock near and under the kelps, or attached to the kelps themselves, a soft red weed that tastes of hazelnuts. At their feet, and in among the claw-like holdfasts of the kelp, are the rock-encrusting corallines, pink weeds that generate their own limey protective skin, some hugging the rock itself as a crust, others tufty in what look like little pink brittle forests. Except they are not brittle. Those tufted corallines are provided with their own calcium carbonate armour to resist predators. But look close and you will see that their stems are bobbled, the strong protected lengths regularly interrupted with soft, flexible joints, like the elbows or knees in a suit of armour, so that storm waves will not break them. What could be better organised than this? At least 10 different sorts of seaweed are here, each laid out as if in a library, neatly within its place, happily coexisting alongside its companions. But that is not true. Heraclitus remains the presiding spirit here, and translocation experiments have shown that this is not a picture of order, but of competition between the weeds. Channeled rack would happily grow all the way down to the kelps if it could, but a succession of rivals from spiral to bladder and knotted rack all do better than it and shut it out. Mutual exclusion is the overriding process. Bladder rack can grow happily where spiral rack covers the rocks, but the spiral rack won't let it. Serrated rack would grow higher up the shore, but bladder rack won't let it. Serrated rack outcompetes the kelps. All of them shade out their lower neighbours. Look at one of these soggy, slithery shores, and you are looking at a battle of the weeds. Any constancy here is only the stability of a whirling top held in place by the interaction of forces in tension. Should one of those forces drop away, the system goes into crisis. Few events have been more revealing than the wrecking in March 1967 of the Torrey Canyon, one of the early supertankers, on the rocks of the Seven Stones Reef between Land's End in Cornwall and the Scilly Isles. The ship was on a tight deadline to arrive at the oil refineries in Milford Haven in Pembrokeshire, where it was to discharge its cargo of 117,000 tonnes of Kuwaiti crude. The bridge was without a complete set of charts, had an out-of-date navigation system, and the captain was asleep while the first officer made bad navigational decisions when avoiding a fleet of fishing boats near Scilly. These vast ships, almost 1,000 feet long, travel fast, and the Torrey Canyon struck the reef at 17 knots, tearing open 6 of her 18 storage tanks and damaging the others. Over the next 6 weeks she broke up, partly as storms tore at the hull, partly when the Royal Air Force and Royal Navy bombed the wreck, setting fire to the oil. By the end of April, the tanks were empty and the oil had spread over 270 square miles of sea. About 20,000 seabirds were killed. The British government was acutely conscious of the holiday beaches in Cornwall and authorised the use of some highly toxic chemicals that had been developed to clean oily surfaces in ships' engine rooms. About 14,000 tons of oil came ashore on 90 miles of the Cornish coast, and 10,000 tons of these dispersants were applied to them. Nothing could have been worse. The dispersants combined with the oil to make long-lasting and deeply poisonous scums, far more toxic and more ingestible by shore life than the undispersed oil would have been. In some remote and inaccessible beaches, drums of neat dispersant were rolled over the edges of the cliffs and allowed to split open on the rocks below. At Gadrevy, near St. Ives, the headland was owned by the National Trust, who were anxious about the effect of the chemicals on the seals, and so they were not applied there. To everyone's surprise, the common limpets at Gadrevy began to browse on the untreated oil, helping to clear the rock surfaces of the slick that had come ashore. Elsewhere, the damage was catastrophic. Vast areas of seaweed were killed, along with the fish, crabs, winkles, topshells, mussels and barnacles that lived among them. The limpets in particular were poisoned and died in uncounted numbers. Along this coastline, the life of the shore and all its interrelationships had been destroyed, and in response, it went into extraordinary spasms of reaction and recovery. The absence of the limpets, which had grazed on the weed, resulted in that first summer in a sudden flush of bright green gutweed and sea lettuce, whose spread had previously been held down by the limpet grazers. That was followed by a secondary, more long-lasting flush of the various brown wracks, which outcompeted the green weeds and established a dense canopy in whose shade all the surviving barnacles died, smothered by weed, eaten by dog whelks, or plucked off the rocks when the big stands of wrack that were growing on them were torn away in storms. Nothing was stable. The shore had become a place of wild oscillations, a deregulated world in which the mutual government of weed and grazer had been suspended and successive life forms tyrannized their surroundings. The wrack was growing in places it had never been seen before, blanketing what had been weed-free coastline. Ironically, that heavy cover of serrated bladder and knotted wrack then created an ideal nursery for young limpets coming in as plankton from the open sea. A huge number of limpets populated the wrack forest, and by 1973 they had eaten most of it away. The limpets then starved, abandoning their normal lives, and migrating in a lemming-like front across the shore before many of them died. Because there had been such a huge number of adult limpets, no young limpets had been able to find a place to live among the weed, and so when this generation starved to death in the early 1980s, there were no others to take their place, and the wrack forest boomed again. This alternate pulsing of heavy weed and a heavy limpet presence, followed by the death of the weed and then the death of limpets, continued on into the 2000s, the boom-bust graph of their fluctuations scarcely diminishing over time, but ricocheting between alternative unstable states, still unsettled 50 years after the tanker was wrecked and the shore had been drenched with the dispersants. Why do these chaotic oscillations not happen here? How come there is usually a constancy on these shores? The answer is that the system remains tense. Its inner tautness has not been slackened by any pollutant catastrophe. When I look deep down among the serrated wrack and the kelp, I can find a still coherent world in which neither the grazers, largely limpets and below them the urchins, nor the grazed, the young wracks and kelp, have outcompeted each other. Urchins are plucked off by storms. Total overgrowth by the weeds is kept in check by the grazers. The result is the open ground over which the coralline spread to make the pink and vermilion ballrooms on which these giants browse. It feels like an old and continuous world down here, where the mussels and the sea stars have been known to live for at least 20 years, the urchins up to 16, the sponges and corallines to an age no one has yet been able to compute, all of them at home in the shadows of their polychrome groves. The limpet is the governor. They are long livers too, and some mark the stages of their growth by the regular rings of barnacles that have attached themselves to the shell, stage by stage as the limpet grew. They are adaptable. Those higher up the shore are usually taller, with shells tending towards witches' hats, probably so that when they are out of the water at low tide, they do not get hot. Those lower down the shore are flatter, perhaps because they have less need to cool down, and because a flatter shell is less vulnerable to being knocked off by a wave. Those in the middle shore have forms in between. Often I used to take them back to my aquarium in the house, still attached to the rocks on which I had found them, and watch them wandering around their world, their two forward-facing antennae supplemented by tiny hair-like cilia around the rim of their shells, keeping a lookout to the side and behind, as delicate as eyelashes on a whale. Limpets have embedded in them a tidal clock, and so as the tide falls outside, even though the water level in the aquarium remains constant, they would begin their expeditions. The foot of the animal has a set of muscles through which it can send sequential ripples to create a forward movement. If it wants to turn on the spot, or if it has detected a predator, the muscles on one side can move in a way opposite to the other, and so the limpet rotates like a tank, with its tracks turned to forward on the left and reverse on the right. They are capable of moving 4 inches or even more in a minute, always along the same paths, using their iron-tipped teeth to mow up the microalgae and other vegetable food that are stuck to the mucus trail which their previous journeys apply to the rock. Tests have shown that this stickiness is deliberate. The trails left by carnivorous dog whelks, which have no need to attract the detritus floating in the water, are less sticky and end up far less nutritious than those of the limpets. Some limpets deliberately garden their surroundings, keeping patches of rock near them in such a good mucus, sticky and nutritious state that small pioneer algae of the best tiny vegetable kind will grow there. This is no chance behaviour. Limpets will defend their gardens from others by standing high, an act called mushrooming, to more than twice the height of their shell when at rest, and stamping on the invader. The starfish that try to attack them can have their toes cut off this way. Most of my limpets were apparently solitary, but on some rocks out on the shore they lived in quite large aggregations which are thought to be defensive. If an oyster catcher attacks one limpet on the edge of a crowd, the rest settle down tight to make sure the bird will have no chance of getting under their shells. No one has worked out how a limpet knows that another of its kind, 2 feet away, is being attacked, but it is probably the vibrations coming up through the rock. Limpets feel through the soles of their feet the giant birds trying to eat their neighbours. They are the shore engineers. Wherever I could find the beautiful and open coralline patches around the pool, I could know that the gardening of the limpets was at work, a reduction through their grazing of the weeds that would otherwise overgrow the rocks. There are subtleties here, because the coralline is dependent on the shade provided by the big racks or kelp, and so the system is held in a delicate and poised condition. The coralline needs the rack for its shade, but not too much of it. The limpet needs to eat the young weeds and so needs them to seed the coralline, but must make sure that open coralline-rich ground remains as a viable garden and does not get overgrown. The big racks need some space on which their holdfasts can anchor them to the rock, so they are not destroyed in storms. Each organism needs something of a halfway house, and for the others not to become too dominant. Biologists looking at the shore have seen that this condition of mutual tolerance come control depends on what they have called intermediate disturbance. If there is too little interference by storm or predator, as at the quiet head of the bay, there will be little chance for a diversity of life to thrive. That is also true if there is too much, as on the point of headland where the rocks are often covered in little but limpets and barnacles, because storm waves make life impossible for the weeds. In winter storms, the fronds of the wrack sweep most animals away from the rock. Weeds that have begun to grow on barnacles are poorly attached and can be taken away with the underlying barnacles. In those circumstances, limpets must largely prey on their barnacle neighbours. Only in the middle ground, as here in the half-protected limb of a headland, away from the dominant southwesterlies, is there a chance of riches. Professor Stephen Hawkins, who for decades led research into these relationships at marine laboratories in Liverpool and Southampton, summarised them in a diagram. The wild tip of a headland will have relatively small-scale successions of different forms of life, most of them the hard survival champions of the limpets and the barnacles. The quiet head of the bay will be an equally reduced weedy place where the wracks will luxuriate in simplified quiet. Only here, on moderately exposed places like the eastern edge of Rua Untasenach, will shore life achieve its full and beautiful complexity. The wild oscillations, after the Torrey Canyon episode, do not occur here because much smaller and more regular catastrophes are happening all the time. A storm will tear off a hank of weed, which may take the barnacles and even the coralline with it. A sudden settlement of barnacles will colonise the shore where a gap has opened up. There might have been a slight variation in temperature, even a frost, which killed off a generation of limpets. It is a tickering, flickering landscape, at a scale which we scarcely notice unless we look. But do look. Look at it slowly, and the shore ripples like an oscilloscope, with the interlocking and overlapping patterns of unceasing change. The sea is not made of water, nor a medium in which to swim, but a world to come alongside, to be with, in ways that go beyond the predatory. These oscillations are patches in time, just as the patches on the rock are oscillations in space. Microtides flood and ebb across every dimension of their world. Their micro-catastrophes and micro-blooming are the guarantee of calm. Life is unsealed. There is no distinction between flux and stillness. They are one. The core of being is interplay, and its give and take of quick and still is the animation of life.
This concludes Life Between the Tides by Adam Nicholson, narrated by Leighton Pugh. Copyright 2022 by Adam Nicholson. Production copyright 2020 by HarperCollins Publishers. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Farrar, Straus & Giroux, New York, all rights reserved, and was produced in the year 2022 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright there too. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.